The topic of my talk today is on women's voices. And speaking of women's voices, this is a thing that was clearly made for a man, not for a woman. I don't have a breast pocket to put it in. I will drop it, step on it several times, probably. So if y'all can hear me like this, I would just go without any microphone. I'm used to projecting for classrooms far larger than this. Oh, well, I know, but I'm still going to drop it. I don't have anywhere to put it, and I'm also very concerned that it will hang on my shirt and drop it to unacceptably low latitudes during my more exciting parts of this talk. Okay, the other thing I'd like to put up before I get going, and I promise not to go on too long here, I know that we've done enough today, is that Margie and I did not choose the same color scheme for our clothing on purpose. So I want you to know that we have done this by accident with no prior communication every time that we have stood together in front of this church. Okay, and this morning, again, was another case of that. Okay, what I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to pull a John. I'm changing slightly what I'm talking about. I would like to entitle my sermon today, if you want to call it that, Women's Voices, Women's Power. Okay? Because what happened is that when I sat down to actually think about this sermon and what I was going to say in it, I realized that there was a great deal that I needed to say about this that was not just historical, that pertains to our society today. And how we hear women and how women find strategies to express themselves in a world that is not comfortable hearing them. Okay? And so I'm going to talk about it in a historical sense also in the period, early modern Europe, the Renaissance and the Reformation that I know something about. But where I want to start and where I'm going to end is with a modern example. I'm going to show a little flip here. I am a science fiction fan, not so much in reading, but in watching television. My personal belief is that the best-looking men are usually on the science fiction channel. That's one of the main attractions for me. But I don't know, maybe I'm attracted to aliens. But whatever the reason is, I watch the science fiction channel a lot. And one of my favorite shows, thus, of course, canceled after a few seasons, was called Farscape. And one of the things as I looked back and analyzed that show that fascinated me the most about it is that there were three main women characters in that show. And those three women characters exemplified the three stereotypes of women and women's voices that have been powerful in Western culture from its earliest roots to today. So we're going to start by talking about Farscape. The first woman character to appear on the show was a woman named Erin Sun. She was dressed in black leather from head to toe. She was an ambivalent character in that she starts out as a bad guy, but by the end of the series ended up as the lover and supporter of the main male character. Erin Sun was the Amazon stereotype. She was a woman, but she was a warrior, and thus, for the point of our sermon today, a woman of few words. In fact, a self-described woman of few words. The second character on the show, it was an important woman character, was a girl named Chiana. Chiana had blue hair. She, too, was dressed in clothes more tight-fitting than I could have gotten into when I was 12 years old, let alone 44. Okay, and she exemplified the prostitute slash Mary Magdalene character. She was young, kiddish, sexual, and she was never taken seriously for her words. Occasionally she got to do heroic deeds, but her voice was high and girlish, and it was assumed that one didn't listen to Chiana. Chiana babbled, and she was ignored. She was good at bed, but she wasn't supposed to speak. the third character, and the one who I want to emphasize the most, because she goes to the heart of what I'm going to talk about today, was a character named Zan. And Zan was the priestess character. She was painted blue, but unlike the others, she was actually over 21. She usually didn't wear tight-fitting clothes, although she got a few naked scenes at this table after all. Okay? But her head was shaved, and her power came through her work and her ability to seek wisdom, but also to manipulate men's minds, to the point where in one of my favorite episodes, the bad guys capture her and they find it necessary to wire her mouth shut to control her power. Hello, this was, despite being canceled, one of the most popular science fiction series on the Sci-Fi Channel, and it's going to have a movie in the theaters coming out, hopefully filled with other good-looking men who haven't been killed off, okay, in the course of the series, in another 6 months or so. Okay, the point that I'm trying to make here is that women's voices have been problematic and never more than in a religious sense from the ancient past to the present. After all, what was it that Eve did? It wasn't just that she ate the apple. She listened to the devil and then used her words, her voice, to persuade Adam to commit the sin that got all human beings thrown out of the Garden of Paradise. It was her voice that was a problem. Okay? If she just shut her mouth instead of speaking for the devil, none of us would have credit card debts and war and all the other things that hang over our heads like the sword of Damocles. We would all be living happily in paradise. Okay? Ever since Eve, okay, we've had a deep discomfort with women. Women talk, they nag, they lie, they seduce. They need to be dumped for gossip. Do you realize that scolding and gossip was the single most commonly punished crime for women in New England and in early modern England? Far surpassed witchcraft or infanticide, the other two biggies, okay? Being a scold. Using your voice as a weapon, okay? Women should be quiet, because if they're not, they're like Lady Macbeth. And who knows what they're going to talk their menfolk into doing. And when they're not doing that, they're just gossiping, they're noisy, they're shrill, and they're out of control. And we need to shut them up. All right, here's your history quiz. Quick question. What did Lucrecia de Leon, arrested by the Spanish Inquisition in 1590, Catherine of Siena, died 1380, beatified, Benedetta Carlini of Pescia in Italy, who spent 35 years in prison, Sister Maria de la Visitacion, also condemned to life in prison and twice weekly flogging in Kibbutz, you wouldn't want her to get off lightly, and Teresa of Avila, also beatified, and Anne Hutchinson, threatened with imprisonment, flogging, and hanging, have in common. Anybody know? Answer. Two things. Visions, religious visions, and voices they spoke out about them. Now that's not to mention the stigmata, at least for most of them, except Anne Hutchinson. But anyway, or at least claims to experience the stigmata, which for those of you who are Catholic in background and don't know, is the belief that a truly holy person, as a sign that they have been touched by God's holiness, actually experiences the piercing of the hands and the feet, of the nails, that Jesus underwent, okay? And most female mystics, and by the way, there were hundreds and hundreds of them in the period that I studied, most Catholic ones did this, claimed at least to have the stigmata. Men did, sometimes got the stigmata too. Protestants, very rarely. Jews, obviously, never. Okay. but for Catholic mystics, it was almost a prerequisite of speaking out. Okay? You had to be wounded to earn the right to speak. Okay. Mysticism is very common in religious history. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but one of the central historical points I want to make here is that for women, power and prophecy have always gone together, even before the advent of Christianity. When women spoke in religious history, they spoke not for themselves. Their voices were the voices of God or the devil speaking through them, because it was impossible to accept that a woman could, let alone should, wield the weapon of a powerful voice on her own, that she would have the ability or the right to speak for herself, to interpret the Bible, to make a religious statement. So most of the time, most women in the Renaissance and the Reformation, Protestant and Catholic, who sought to speak out in the religious sense, had to convince their listeners that they were not speaking with their own voices. They were speaking for God. Okay? But this was a very dangerous game for women to play, because if you were found to be fraudulent, then such a powerful persuasive weapon as your voice, accomplishing the work that it was accomplishing, had to have been by means of the power of the devil, if it wasn't God. And needless to say, the punishments for that were severe. Now, I could spend a lot of time, actually, on witchcraft, the devil, power, sexuality. I will probably save that for another sermon. I wrote some stuff down here about it, but I won't get into it in that respect. But what I also want to talk about, before I finish up here, is what did it take to convince authorities that you were speaking for God? I think that it's very telling what it took to convince them. Number one, you had to have a male supporter, sort of like a modern-day publicist, okay? You couldn't go out there yourself and just convince people higher up in the church or the authorities, oh, well, God's speaking through me. What you had to do was have your visions and prophecies and speak out, and then go with a troubled mind, of course, to your father confessor. And so we see lots and lots of sort of couples acts in early modern religion and prophecy, where you have a woman, usually, although not always, young, and her male protector and supporter who takes her case to higher authorities. If things went well, you could have a situation like Catherine of Siena or Teresa of Avila, where you would actually be able to make pronouncements, political pronouncements, as in the case of Lucrezia, who basically said Philip II was a crummy king, and these would actually get all the way to the ears of the king or of the pope. Your voice could be carried very high. But again, it was a dangerous game, because the assumption was a deep skepticism about the true holiness and prophetic ability of the woman speaking. So it helped enormously if you were also a virgin and you were a nun, which is why most of these women prophets were nuns, or you were considered too young to have gotten involved in sexual activity. So another thing we see here is we have a triangle. The way to think of it is a triangle. Sex, power, speaking. In order for a woman to wield power, okay, she had to efface her sexuality. Sex and power for women were, and if you look at popular culture today, are an extremely dangerous combination. So you don't find nubile young women with hordes of lovers. You do not find Mary Magdalene who spoke in early modern religion. Okay? Instead, what you found is women who were as sexless as possible, in the holy anorexia sense of the term, okay, or if they were married, they were married to Christ, who turned out to be a far less demanding lover than other husbands, and freed of the necessity of actually having sex, let alone children, they were able to fulfill another criteria, which was service to other people. So another sign that you were truly a mystical prophet was that, like Catherine of Siena, you worked in the leprosarium, taking care of the lepers. You washed the feet of the poor. You dedicated yourself, like Mother Teresa, by the way, today a very beloved and quiet saintly woman, okay? You cared for the poor, and you, again, made yourself as small and humble and effaced in your sexuality and your physicality as possible in order for your voice to be worthy of being heard. The ironic other side of this coin was that the women who spoke out in a demonic sense, accused of witchcraft, what was their central crime? They gained their power through sex with the devil. So again, I want you to see this pyramid here. And the reason why I go into this, and as I say, if you want the historical stuff, I can go on and on about it, but I don't want to go on too long here because we don't have that much time. But I just want to point out that in our modern-day popular culture, you go to the movies, all the same attitudes, all the same images of women, power from nature, power from dark sources, and voices are linked together. Powerful women are quiet women. Powerful women are sexual women. And powerful women are dangerous women. So women who are noisy and speak out, like Teresa Hines Carey, we don't know what to do with, because we are uncomfortable with their voices, okay? And I could point out scene after scene, image after image, movie after movie, okay? But I will just stick with one. X-Men 2 United, the X-Men series, okay? And one of the reasons why I choose this movie is because this is a movie that young people see. This is a movie that influences young people's ideas about male and female roles. Okay? Who do we have there? Halle Berry. Power is a natural power, a magical power. She can control the weather. She is a woman of few words and great power and kind of ambivalent. We have Rose, whose power is the ability every time she gets close to a man, like to kiss him, sucks the life out of him. Hello? She also is very powerful through her sexuality at a woman of few words. And then we have Jean, who's a good girl and is the most sort of talkative, caring, gentle, Shoe-Craig type of person. Her power is telepathy, but it doesn't get to be very telepathic until she has a freak accident, and even then she can't surpass a male mentor, Charles Xavier. The men's powers are Wolverine. Now, if he meets up with a bad girl, well, I guess we can call her She Wolverine-S, okay, who is extremely powerful and has not a single line in the movie, from the point when she appears to the point where Wolverine whacks her by pumping her full of molten adamantine. Okay, I'm not even going to go where we could go with some of those issues, okay? Metallo, need I say more? Okay, Cyclops, fire from his eyes. The same stereotypes that have characterized attitudes about women's roles and women's voices in the past still characterize our attitudes about women's roles and women's voices in society today. And I would finish on this note. I do not believe that women will ever really have true authority, forget about power, but authority in our society and true equality until we learn to be comfortable with their voices, until we learn to stop expecting that they should only speak through men or simply sit back and be quiet, okay? Until we learn to be comfortable with outspoken women. And I think we ought to take a look at religions all across the board, and women's voices are the lack therein, because that is emblematic of our discomfort with hearing women's voices speaking with authority, and especially in religious settings and on religious issues. Okay, that's it. I'm done. I came in a little over time, but that's it.
Thank you. Shall we take a few questions? I'll ask the first question. I'm not on the floor. As I mentioned to you, Gail, when I was preparing to be a service associate, I was looking for some reading for some of these Renaissance women. So I found some stuff that had been written by Catherine of Siena and Teresa of Avila and some other people. But as you mentioned, all their writings seemed to be written about God, you know, because a lot of them were nuns. And so I decided that none of those readings were going to work for us. So I used a modern-day woman's voice as my opening. But one of the women, when I was reading about her, I don't remember which one it was. It might have been Teresa of Avila, but I don't remember. I was reading something that she wrote, and she referred to God as a mother and as a father. She sort of used a Trinitarian piece, but she definitely brought in the mother piece of it, and I thought that was very interesting, and that was the only sort of hint I saw of feminism from these women. But I wanted you to comment on that. I don't remember which woman it was.
Well, first of all, Teresa of Avila was beatified and not burned by the skin of her teeth. Okay? She was one of the lucky ones. And yes, this is very interesting, and it's one of the reasons why she's a favorite of women's historians and feminist scholars. Most of her imagery of God is actually of the more generic of Christ as her spouse, which sometimes also made hearers uncomfortable because some of that imagery got real uncomfortable in sort of a Song of Solomon, a sense of uncomfortable. Okay, for those of you who are familiar with the Song of Solomon and its sexual imagery. Okay, but she did sometimes also refer to God as a mother. And it's interesting that she didn't get into more trouble for that. But one of the reasons was that she was always willing to efface herself in terms of putting herself out there in the world, and also because of the fact that what she didn't do, which was a far greater no-no than referring to God as a mother, was she didn't make the kinds of political pronouncements that Catherine of Siena or Lucrezia did. And by the way, if you're interested in this topic, one of the best books to introduce you to it is a book called Lucrezia's Dream by a guy named Richard Kagan, which is about one of these female mystics. It does not have a happy ending, I will warn you now, but it is a wonderfully written book that gives you a sense of what these women were like.
Any other questions?
Gail, I'm intrigued about Queen Elizabeth the First, whether she was perceived more as a man in women's clothes, or was there an antipathy or resistance to her, and does that offer any hope or solace to Hillary Clinton?
I would say solace, because unfortunately Hillary Clinton has already had way more sex in her life than Queen Elizabeth at least was reputed to have ever had. And I say that not just trying to keep. That is the big issue. What the issue was with Queen Elizabeth was the assumption was always that if a woman spoke, she should speak for or through a man. So there was intense pressure upon her to get married. What saved her from getting married was the intense fear that if she picked the wrong guy, she would be speaking for and through a man who would be like her practicer, Mary, Queen Mary, who married Philip II of Spain in a morganatic marriage that resulted in a number of false pregnancies, but that's another story. But it was perceived in England that Mary was persecuting Protestants and doing all these things because of the power of her husband. So for Elizabeth, these two forces of, you know, yes, we want her to get married, but no, not if it's to the wrong guy, kind of canceled themselves out. But what Elizabeth ultimately did was to adopt another model. She became the Virgin Queen. She became, in other words, you've got the models, the virgin, the prostitute, the witch slash crone, okay? And I guess mother, you can put in there. Those are your models for women. So mother and wife wasn't going to work. Obviously, neither was crone or witch, although at the end of her life, I'm sure a lot of people would beg to differ with that. She ended up with a model, essentially, I am neither male or female, sort of like Teresa of Avila's discussion of God as a mother or a father. I am simply the mother of the country. However, even so, beloved though she was during her life, when she died, her heir and successor, James, wrote something about along the lines of the horrible abomination of the rule of women. Okay, so her example was not an example that people were comfortable with, and I would say that even today, our conceptualization of the rule of women is still closer, unfortunately, to that of James than it would be to Elizabeth. Yes?
Well, years ago, when we were in Spain, we happened to go visit Avila, and I was surprised to find that Teresa's finger is on display.
I'm surprised they don't have nerve.
Story behind that?
I'm sure there is. I don't know what it was, but I can tell you that it was actually very common to have bits and pieces of saints, even at the late date of the 17th century, because she was, of course, a Baroque saint, and there's some wonderful Baroque art of her mystical union with God, with the flames of God coming down and her looking up. But actually, as I say, I'm not surprised that there aren't more bits and pieces of her circulating around. Yes, right.
Diane,
basically because she kept her mouth shut. She spoke out about, and when she spoke out, it was about things that women are allowed to speak out about. The one province where women have traditionally been able to speak out is protection of family and children. And that, remember, that was her big cause. And so the problem that people had with Diana was she was beloved as this, who she was compared to, Charles, okay, you know, Mr. Marble, okay, you know. I mean, basically, she came off better as being more sympathetic and gentle and so on, but at the same time, people were uncomfortable with the whole sexual situation. But what she did not do was make a lot of pronouncements on political issues or purport to speak with authority outside of the permissible province. And if you look at first wives or potential first wives in this country, you will see that it's the same thing. There are boundaries in which women are allowed to speak, but speaking with religious authority, okay, or theological authority or political authority are areas in where there is still, I would argue, a lot of discomfort. Oh boy. One more? Okay. Yes. Well, the rise of interest in Mary can be ascribed to probably several things. One thing, remember, Mary didn't have a whole lot to say. So in the terms of the theme of my talk today, she was a quiet woman. But the other issue here is that Mary was a safe woman. In other words, a woman who could be safely adored because she was loving, forgiving, a mother figure, mother of the church, safely physically removed so that we didn't have to worry about too much sexual temptation or sexual imagery here. And she was conceived to be the best that a woman could be. So again, the issue with Mary is if you want to understand what was, and I would argue in many people's minds today still is, the ideal of a truly holy, perfect woman, look at Mary. Virgin, mother, at the same time, thus unattainable for, well, 99.9% of the rest of us, okay, and quiet. All right, I've been told that I'm out of time.
I would be interested if you had one or two suggestions about how we as modern women might go about helping to achieve a better balance.
Number one is refuse to shut up. Okay, I say that because needless to say that's what I do. I can't help myself. I can't. Okay, but the other, and not just refuse to shut up, but insist on being heard in those forums where you're not usually heard, where it's uncomfortable to be heard. And the other thing is to try, those of us who have children, unlike me, who are raising children or were in contact with young people, try to emphasize, to point out how these stereotypes work in modern culture. One of the things that I do in my classroom, even though I'm teaching about the Renaissance, is I'm always doing just what I did today. I'm bringing in popular culture images about women, and I'm pointing out, let's be postmodern. Let's be constructive. What does this say? What does this mean? What does this tell you about attitudes, about how you're supposed to be now? And then I'll compare them with older attitudes. Because the biggest problem, I think, is that most of us are not consciously aware of our attitudes that circulate in our own heads. So that would be my other piece of advice.